This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/MBO. Terms and conditions apply.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Some people are good at what they do. Some are enthusiastic about their work. It's exciting and rare to encounter someone with both qualities. Today, we're privileged to talk with a distinguished figure in the world of archaeology who combines both excellence in his field and enthusiasm for it. Professor Aaron Mayer is not only an accomplished archaeologist, but also a captivating storyteller who brings the past to life through his discoveries. He directs the Tel Safi Gat Archaeological Project in Israel, teaches biblical and ancient Near Eastern archaeology at Bar Ilan University, and serves as head of its Institute of Archaeology. Professor Mayer's expertise in biblical archaeology has shed light on ancient civilizations and events. Welcome to the Van Leer Institute series on ideas. Follow us on Spotify and wherever you find your podcasts. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host, and I'm honored to welcome Aaron Mayer to the show today to share some of the secrets archaeology reveals. Aaron Mayer, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
First, let me congratulate you on your breakthrough finding that was just published. Tell us about that.
Well, we published an article in which using archaeomagnetic analyses, that means you can measure the direction, intensity, inclination of the magnetic earth, which changes over time. And if you have materials that were burnt and quickly cooled on a specific event, so it tells you, it retains that information from way back. And we've been using this in recent times, both to date, destruction levels. For example, the destruction wrought by Hazael in around 830 BCE at Gat. I got to the Philistines where I excavate, as you mentioned, but it also can tell us information, for example, about the intensity of the fire, the temperature of the fire, the types of building materials, etc. And this was one of the things that was done in this study that was just published. And I would say that from the broader perspective, we also use these methods to compare the dates of different destruction events that are known historically from the land of Israel during the Iron Age, more or less what we would call in popular history the First Temple period. For example, the destruction of Hazael at Gat, the destruction of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, at Lachish, the destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar the Babylonian, and in each place and the relevant sites where these destructions occurred, the paleomagnetic signature of that specific time was left, and we could retain it. We could define it based on the finds.
And that confirmed the biblical report of
the event. What it does, and it First of all, it shows you which sites, you know, so for example, if I know that Gat was destroyed by Hazael in 830, and there are other sites in the region, which it have been suggested as perhaps being destroyed by Hazael, but we have no historical evidence of this. If the paleomagnetism at Gat is similar to the paleomagnetism, let's say, of another site at Afek, or Tel Zayit or something like that. So you can say, yes, indeed, we can, you know, connect between the these destruction events and connect them to the same event. Now, in the case of Gat, we've already suggested in the past that the destruction that we excavated is the same destruction mentioned in the biblical text in the Book of Kings, where it mentions very briefly that Hazael captured in Gat. But I would say this is an additional brick in the wall that we've built, how to explain this destruction. What's the historical context of the destruction that we've been excavating at Gat?
Fascinating. In addition to all your extensive professional responsibilities, you have also taught, and maybe still teach, a MOOC, a massive open online course on biblical archaeology. Mm-hmm. Why is it important to you to educate the public about archaeology in general and biblical archaeology in particular?
Okay, so first of all, I'm very much in the opinion of a lot of the teaching that is done today, both in universities, but also elementary and secondary schools, use methods of teaching which are not necessarily optimal and not always utilizing all the various methods that exist, and not taking into account the very changing attention spans and ways people acquire knowledge nowadays. You know, because basically universities have been around since about 1000 CE, and we haven't changed too much. So for example, in Corona, due to the fact that we couldn't meet, so we very easily incorporated Zoom teaching into our repertoire. And I don't think Zoom teaching is the optimal method. It's one of the methods that you should incorporate. And I think the same thing goes for online teaching methods such as the MOOCs, the massive open online courses, where people can register for a course on a specific topic, and the course is built in a way that it's not just a video of some dodgy professor speaking in a class, you know, the same way he does in regular class, but all kinds of short sound bites of a few minutes, 7 to 9 minutes videos, and then all kinds of other things that you do. And this enables you to teach material on the one hand at an academic level, and the MOOC that I made on biblical archaeology is an undergraduate course at Bar-Ilan University, which Bar-Ilan students can take, but also people from all over the world. And so far, more than 10,000 people from all over the world, and some really unbelievable countries, including countries that have absolutely no relationship with Israel, have taken this course. And it enables them to get a feeling of what biblical archaeology is today, what's cutting edge, what do we talk about, how we study, etc. Now, I think this is important both for students studying archaeology or related topics such as history, biblical studies, ancient Near East, anthropology, etc. It's important for them because it gives them another, bit of information related to their fields. But I think it's also important for the general public, and that for several reasons. First of all, the general public funds archaeology. What we do is funded by the governments, by public, etc., sometimes donations. And I think it's our duty to not only keep our finds and our expertise, within the journals that belong to our profession, but spread them out further as well. That's one thing. The other thing is biblical archaeology is, I would say, very often misunderstood in the public. And there's very often this image that biblical archaeologists are out there to either prove or disprove the Bible, and that's what we do, And I think it's important to show that what we're doing is cutting edge archaeology, that is study of the material remains of the human past, in this case, in the context of the cultures and peoples and periods in which the Bible was formed and appeared, you know, over in a complex manner. So I think it's very, very important to show the public what we're doing. Now, one of the funny things in archaeology is that for some reason, people think that the public thinks that if you sit down and read, you know, two articles and two books, you become an expert in archaeology. And I at least once a month, and just this morning, I get emails from people who have come from a completely different field and have obviously read a little about archaeology and come up with these revolutionary understandings of the past. Most often, without any intimate knowledge of the details, so what they suggest is baseless. And I always find this funny because nobody would write an email to a neurosurgeon and say, "Oh, I read a book about introduction to neurosurgery, so I suggest that you conduct your brain surgery in a different way, or I'll interpret your finds in a different way." For some reason, the public has this feeling that archaeologists, they know something. So I think it's important for archaeologists who are professionals, who know what they're doing, who know how to present their finds, to put it out to the public, so they get a feeling of not only what we do and how we do it and what we find, is also the complexity of the science behind it, and why what we're doing is not just off the cuff explanation, based on what we feel like should be said, or based on, as sometimes people using archaeology for their political agendas, and modern archaeologists very much try not to be like that.
Well,
I'll just add one more thing. In addition to the biblical archaeology MOOC, which has been running for several years now, I'm currently working on a MOOC on ancient Jerusalem, which hopefully will be out somewhere in mid to late 2024, and will be a similar type of course, to use the tools that are available in digital pedagogy to explain about the history and archaeology of Jerusalem.
I'll keep my eyes out for that one. How has the public perception and attitude toward archaeology changed during your career? The mass media, or maybe the movies of Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones add or make a problem for it?
No, I think, first of all, I always, just about all archaeologists tell their students is that on the one hand, what Indiana Jones does in his movie has very little to do with archaeology, with real archaeology. But on the other hand, he has done a great service to archaeology because he has made people interested in it. People are fascinated by it. And in fact, many people started studying archaeology because of the Indiana Jones movie, even though at some point they realized that it's not connected, but that was a very good starting point. One of the things that's absolutely obvious is that archaeology fascinates the public. And I can see this from several ways. First of all, I have never, when people come up to you and say, "Oh, what do you do?" And I'll say, "An archaeologist." I would say almost every single time that someone hears that answer, that's a cool top, field. Oh, I wish I could be an archaeologist. Tell me about that. That's one thing. The other thing I know is from talks with friends who are journalists, whenever archaeology appears in a newspaper, and they can measure this on the internet editions, it's one of the most read items that day. The public is very interested in archaeology. And that's why I would say there isn't a week in Israel and in other parts of the world where you don't have on major news outlets archaeological articles, a new find, a new understanding, etc. And they're very, very minded for this. And I think because of that, the public is very open to hear about archaeology. Now, that's why it's very important, in my opinion, for the mainstream archaeologists who are doing good science, who are out there and utilizing the most modern methods in their research to have their voice heard in the mainstream media. Because it's very easy for all kinds of, marginal or sometimes lunatic voices to come out and say, oh, yes, we found, I don't know, the Noah's Ark or, where Moses gave the Ten Commandments and all kinds of things that could, and the public eats that up because it's dog bites a man, a man bites a dog instead of a dog bites a man. And I think it's very important for the mainstream archaeologists to be out there, one, to talk about their finds and the exciting methods that we use to understand the past. And really archaeology nowadays is such an inter and multidisciplinary field in which we utilize the most fascinating aspects of science to understand the past, whether it's, paleomagnetism, whether it's DNA, whether it's isotope analysis and paleoclimate studies, all kinds of fascinating methods. And the public is interested in it. And so if the public is interested in it, we should, as archaeologists, feed the public the data of real research and not let the marginal, questionable types of conclusions come out there. And I think also when the questionable ones come out, I think it's our job as archaeologists to counter those things. And for example, recently, a supposed inscription on a piece of lead from the early Iron Age site of Ebal was published, and it was suggested that that's the sacrificial altar built by Joshua mentioned in the Bible, and then there's a curse on it, some curse similar to what's written in the Bible, and me and a bunch of other colleagues looked at this object and said, hey guys, this is not an inscription, there's no inscription here, and probably this whole thing is a fishing weight, not something dramatic and biblically oriented, as they had said. So I think it's also important to present your research and also to counter poor research. And I think that's very, very important in general, because I think it's in science in general. If you let flat earthers talk all the time in the media, people will start believing, the earth is flat. Now, that's gibberish. But if you don't have a scientist who can show you why that is foolish and not even worthy of discussion, so people start believing it. So the same thing goes for archaeology.
Right. Well, archaeologists not only help us understand the past, they are used now in the present to our great sorrow. Israeli archaeologists have been called to apply their skills in the modern tragedies to talk about how archaeology is helping identify victims of the horrific October 7th Hamas massacre.
Okay, so now archaeologists, to a large extent, use tools that are very similar to what we would call, crime scene investigators, CSI, because both fields are looking for material remains of people and their activities, whether in the far past or in a much more recent past. We've known for many years that there's a lot of overlap between these two fields. Archaeologists, for example, have been used in the past there have been archaeological excavations at Nazi extermination camps, they've actually helped find remains of what went on there. Archaeologists were used to study the remains and find remains of people from the 9/11 towers that when they came down, and also from, the mass murderers, for example, in the former Yugoslavia. This is something that has been done in the past. Here, though, after the October 7th massacres, we had a very tragic and unique situation where, first of all, there were, in several of the kibbutzim that were attacked, people who had been hiding in their houses and hadn't come out, the Hamas terrorists burnt down the houses. And in some cases, the fires were so extensive that when the rooms in these houses, the safe rooms, were opened up, all that remained was burnt ashes. And the people had been so totally consumed by the fire. In many cases, they knew of a certain amount of missing people. And they even knew that someone had been in this house, but when they came to the house, there was nobody there. I mean, the remains were not there. And that's why archaeologists for the Israel Antiquities Authority were called in to excavate the remains in these houses. And in some cases, they actually succeeded in identifying somewhere around 20 individuals based on teeth and some bones and DNA that remained, and that enabled to move people from the status of, missing, unclear what happened, to the status of unfortunately killed, but at least the families could understand what happened to their loved ones. And the same thing, by the way, happened also the missing persons unit in the army was using similar methods in the cases of some of the army bases where soldiers had been burnt in the places where they were, and they used DNA methods to identify the people. And it's horrendous. Stuff that you see. I visited some of the sites where this was it was done. It was shocking. It's hard to grasp. I'm in total awe of my colleagues who could do this, because it's just being there once. I cry about it when I think about it. It was some way to utilize, the methods that we have to study the past in a way that can assist in the present in some way, in these horrible, tragic circumstances.
Yeah.
Sergeant and Mr. Smith, you're going to love this house.
Bunk beds in a closet?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/MBO. Terms and conditions apply.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Well, let's move back to a less emotionally wrenching topic. Mm-hmm. Your own particular focus is on the Bronze and Iron Ages. What fascinates you about those time periods? What was happening in Israel and the region at the time?
Well, the Bronze and Iron Age in general is more or less, let's say, between 4,000 or 5,000 BCE, somewhere around that, till about 500 BCE. So that's from the beginning of the Bronze Age, which is the beginning of village cultures and then urban cultures. And then we go through ups and downs, of city-states and empires controlling the region. We come to the Iron Age. That's the period of the Israelite and the Judahite kingdoms, which are finally, captured and taken over by the Assyrian Empire and then the Babylonian Empire. Once the Babylonian Empire is over, and the beginning of the Persian period, that's when we That's more or less the end of the Iron Age. So I deal with the period, let's say, from the first villages or first cities until the end of the Iron Age. Now, what's fascinating about this period is that it's a, on the one hand, it's a period where we start having textual sources that relate to this region. It's not a fully, it's not a prehistoric period in which we don't have any written material. But on the other hand, we don't have that much. And even the material, written materials that we have, such as the biblical text, but others, doesn't tell us the whole story. So it's a very interesting, an archaeologist studying these periods has, a, on the one hand, studies the material remains and tries to see how they interface with the mostly limited textual remains that they have. So it's a very interesting, I would say, exercise in combining the material remains with the at times sparse, at times a little more textual remains. That's one thing. The other thing that I find fascinating about these periods is that these are periods in which events and peoples and things that happened are known to us in this in this or that manner from both the biblical text, but also all kinds of ancient Near Eastern texts, Egyptian, Assyrian, etc. And some of them are part of our very, very basic, I would say, foundational civilization, you know, in the West or in the Judeo-Christian world, you know, things, stories about the Bible, etc. Some of them completely made up, some of them reflecting actual events. So, so I mentioned before, Nebuchadnezzar or Sennacherib, etc. So these are people and events that are mentioned in the Bible. And it's very fascinating to try to compare between what we know and think about these events and what the archaeological remains tell us. That's one thing. And I think in general, not only specific to these periods, archaeology, as far as I'm concerned, is going through one of the most fascinating revolutions in what we're doing. And I like to say that if I compare what I was taught as a student of archaeology in the early 1980s, when I started studying archaeology, and compare it to what me and my colleagues can and are doing nowadays in the field of archaeology and the methods that we use and the windows that have been opened to interpret the past, I like comparing it, it's sort of between 19th century medicine and 21st century medicine. We have the same overall objectives, but our toolbox has expanded so broadly that we now can study and get insights on the past on all kinds of things that were simply unavailable, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, and of course, 100 years ago. They simply were beyond beyond their, you know, their grasp because these methods were not there. And I mentioned before, you know, ancient DNA, it's not the answer to all our questions in archaeology, but it definitely opens up a lot of interesting things. The study of paleomagnetism, the study of, for example, the contents of vessels. We now can analyze vessels and tell you what was in the vessel. I mean, the most fascinating thing for me is not too long ago, we studied, we took some vessels which we suspected had alcoholic beverages in them in the past. And when analyzed, it turned out they were still a small environments within the ceramic matrix of these vessels in which there were remains of the yeast that had originally been used in these vessels for the alcoholic beverages. In fact, it probably was beer. We managed to identify the yeast, to regrow them, and we even made beer using the same yeast that we found from these ancient vessels. So, I mean, I think these are, wow, you know, it's like, that's almost, you know, like a Frankenstein story. It's fascinating. All the methods that we have nowadays that enable us to really, you know, delve further into the past. Now, the past is never 100% exposed to us. You know, we, because the past you know, is only partially survives, you know, in the archaeological remains. But nevertheless, our understanding of the past has expanded substantially. And it's a very exciting period. You know, I don't think there's a month goes by without some new method, usually from the sciences, can be shown to be integrated in archaeology and can give us more insights on the past.
What's it like for you emotionally to uncover something or explain something that no one has seen or known for thousands of years?
Well, as you said at the beginning, I really enjoy archaeology, and I enjoy doing it, and I enjoy explaining about it. And I think one of the fascinating parts of archaeology is with every time you stick your trowel into the ground and you turn over the sediments, something new may appear, and something that is can very often be revolutionary. And as opposed, for example, biblical scholars, save for the discovery of, I don't know, the Dead Sea Scrolls 50 years ago or 70 years ago, their material is still the same material. You know, they're studying the same material again and again. They get insights, they understand it better, but their materials have not expanded substantially. In archaeology, every single year, we have new finds which help us understand the past better, sometimes revolutionize us, our understanding of the past. And it's, there's always something new. There's always something new. You know, if you miss out on what happened in the excavations in the summer, very often you miss out some of the very important finds that came up that are relevant to the basic understanding of a certain period, culture, you know, event, et cetera.
Many of our listeners might not realize that they can actually get involved in archaeological digs. Why should someone mm-hmm. who is not an archaeologist nor an historian be interested in participating in a dig?
Well, there's a famous saying that was said by an archaeologist that archaeology is the most fun you can have with your pants on.
Good line.
It really, from my experience, both as when I was a kid, I volunteered at excavations, and then I participated in excavations. And in the last 30 years that I've been excavating more or less at Tel Asafi, we've had thousands upon thousands of people who have volunteered to excavate, both from Israel, from all kinds of countries all over the world. And not a single person of the thousands of people who came said, "Oh, I'm sorry that I came. It was a waste of time." Just about everybody had a ball. It's both the feeling of discovering the past, and there is nothing, you know, if you want to learn about the past, you know, like in many things, the best way is to feel it tangibly. And if you can pick up a decorated shirt that's related to the Philistine culture, and you see that as you pick it up, and you can say, well, the Philistine culture, that's about the time of, I don't know, the prophets, you know, so if you're familiar with the Bible, that talks to you, and if you're familiar with other things, and it's a tangible connection to the past, which is very, very powerful. That's one thing. The other thing is, so many of us grow up in urban, very modernized environments, and many don't have a chance to go out into the field, into a non-urban and not even a rural area, you know, sometimes in the middle of the desert or something of the sort, and get a feeling of being out in the field and participating in exciting research. And also you very often have a very interesting combination of archaeologists and students and volunteers from all over the world, which produce a very, very, very unique camaraderie about what's going on. So I think it's a highly recommended activity for anybody interested in the past, anybody interested in seeing how modern methods are used to study the past, to get a feeling of all the friendship that it gets. And you can volunteer whether in excavations that are conducted in Israel, but in fact, throughout the world, archaeologists are very open to have interested non-professionals volunteer and participate in excavations. Some have, you know, a very, very structured volunteer program, such as many excavations in Israel, but some also just accept people. You know, you can come for a day or a week and work on an excavation and get the feeling of what's going on. And it's a lot of fun.
Finally, Aaron, if some of our listeners would like to learn more about archaeology and biblical archaeology, can you recommend some books or other resources?
Well, first of all, right now I'm writing a textbook on the archaeology of the land of Israel from the Neolithic period until the coming of Alexander. So I hope this will be out in about a year. So hopefully that will be one. There are many sources. I, for example, have a blog at got.wordpress.com. But there are many other ones. There's the Biblical Archaeology Review, which is a sort of like a very popular review of what's going on in Israel in archaeology. And just about all the excavation projects in Israel have a website where they update on their finds. The Israel Antiquities Authority has a nice website. There's plenty of resources out there. I think if you Google archaeology Israel, anybody will find 10 excellent resources on what's going on.
Great. Thank you. That's helpful, I'm sure. Well, this has been a delightful conversation, Aaron. Thanks so much for taking the time to come on the show today.
My pleasure.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff.